You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading, Volume 175 in Steiner's collected works of Steiner's lectures on building stones for an understanding of the mystery of Golgotha, human life in a cosmic context, 17 lectures, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is lecture 13, given in Berlin on the 17th of April, 1917. There is much about events taking place now and in the way that they will come to be shaped in the immediate future, which can be understood in its true essence if one sees these events as a continuation of what took place in the early years of the Christian era. This may sound somewhat paradoxical today, and yet the reason why it is difficult for many people today to understand how certain forces, which were implanted into the evolution of humanity and the earth during the spread of Christianity, could still be exerting an influence now, is that the view that prevails among our contemporaries is that one should not consider the deeper impulses, the deep forces that underlie contemporary events, but merely look at what is happening on the surface. The deeper spiritual forces are inaccessible to people today because they do not want to consider them. On the other hand, anyone who wishes to penetrate, even to a small extent, to what lies beneath the surface of events in our time, will, in many a document that is currently published amidst wide acclaim, often by individuals who are unaware of the motives that determine their actions, become aware of impulses that are often a continuation and even a reappearance of certain impulses that were manifested especially in the early centuries of the Christian era. It is not even possible to characterize the most significant, in quotes, revivals, as one might call them, of former impulses in our time, because people cannot tolerate such characterizations. But those who study the early Christian centuries from a certain standpoint will be able to detect the forces that are actively at work and making a reappearance. It is therefore my aim to draw your attention to certain phenomena associated with the spread of Christianity in the early centuries of the Christian era, because through the appropriate use of the ideas that can be arrived at as a result, you will be able to, quite naturally, to understand much that is taking place today. Today I want to contribute something that arises out of our recent studies, which may serve as a basis for what we will consider afterward and will enable these subsequent investigations to be fruitful. I have often spoken to you about this strange and remarkable fact that the first Roman emperors had acquired their initiation by forcible means. I have also pointed out that many of their actions arose from the fact that they had forced their way into initiation, and therefore knew certain things associated with cosmic events and the impulses relating to them, while nevertheless, as we saw last time, using the secrets derived from the mysteries to their own advantage. The first thing to be aware of when considering these matters is that the appearance of the Christ impulse on the stage of human history was not merely an outward event on the physical plane, which one can understand by considering the historical facts available, but that it was a truly spiritual event. I have already pointed out the profound significance of the fact that Christ was first recognized by demonic beings. We are told that Christ performed miracles of healing, which are described in the Gospels as the casting out of demonic spirits. We are, moreover, constantly made aware on the one hand that the demonic beings who had resided in people knew who Christ was. And on the other hand, it is pointed out to us that Christ himself said to the demons that the time had not yet come to speak about him, and that they should not say who he was. Thus one can say that the appearance of Christ was not only accompanied by the judgment of human beings. It might well have been the case that human beings did not at first have the slightest idea what lay behind the appearance of Christ. But the demonic beings, spirits who were to be thought of as belonging to a supersensible world, recognized him. It was therefore an event whose recognition involved the spiritual world. The more knowledgeable leaders of the early Christians were very clearly aware that the coming of Christianity was not merely an earthly event, that what had taken place was not an event of the earthly world alone, but that it was something that concerned the spiritual world and had, in a certain sense, brought about a radical change in the spiritual world. This was the firm conviction of these leaders and inspirers of the early church. Now, it is a curious phenomenon that the Roman emperors, who were aware of certain mysteries of the spiritual world, because of having forced their way into initiation, had, to one degree or another, an intuitive sense of the whole far-reaching significance of the Christ impulse. There were, of course, some of these Roman emperors who, despite having forced their way into initiation, understood little about the mysteries. But there were also some who understood to the point where they were able to divine something of the power and potential influence of the Christ mystery. And it was these more gifted and perceptive among these initiated emperors who began to adopt a certain policy toward the growing movement of Christianity. The first emperor after Augustus, Tiberius, already started working in this way. One could object that Christianity had not spread by this time, but such an objection would not be valid. For Tiberius, through having been initiated into the ancient mysteries to a certain degree, was well aware that something significant was going on when he learned of Christ's birth in Palestine. Thus we need to consider for a moment how the policy that the initiated Roman emperors were to follow toward Christianity began already under Tiberius, who announced his intention to acknowledge Christ as one of the Roman gods. The Roman Empire had a quite specific policy toward worship of the gods. Essentially, this policy was that when the Romans conquered a people, they received the gods of the conquered race into their Olympic fold. That is to say, they declared that these gods were worthy of veneration, and they were added to the gods already recognized by Rome, with the result that the family of Roman gods gradually grew in number. This policy was followed by the Roman rulers in order to take over those whom they conquered, not only on a material level, but also in spirit and in soul. Moreover, the initiated emperors were very far from seeing in these gods merely the outward images, or indeed what the ordinary people saw. They knew that behind what was manifested in the images of the gods, truly spiritual powers were present from the various hierarchies. This policy was, therefore, totally understandable and made perfect sense. For the power inherent in the principles of Roman rule was to be augmented by the power that resided in the acknowledging and assimilation of the gods. And as a rule, not only was the religion associated with these gods taken over in an outward and exoteric sense, but the secrets of the associated mysteries were also received into the Roman mystery centers and connected with the mystery cult of the ancient Roman Empire. Since at that time there was the prevailing view that it was neither right nor possible to govern without the support of spiritual powers, such as were represented by the gods, such a policy was adopted as a matter of course. The aim of Tiberius was, therefore, simply to integrate the power of Christ, as he imagined it, with the impulses that emanated from the divine forces recognized by him and those whom he governed. The Roman Senate thwarted his intentions, and nothing came of them. But the initiated emperors constantly made such attempts, as did Hadrian, for example. Again and again, however, this was resisted by the dignitaries who wielded a certain influence against this policy of the initiated emperors. Now, if we examine that objections were actually raised against this policy, we can form a good idea of what was really going on at this highly significant turning point of human and earthly evolution. What we behold is a remarkable interplay of forces. On innumerable occasions, Roman writers, influential Roman individuals, and in their wake, large sections of the Roman public, expressed their opposition to the Christians, who, as they increased in number, were becoming more conspicuous, accusing them of profaning what others held sacred, and of regarding as sacred what others considered to be profane. That is to say, the Romans repeatedly asserted and emphasized that these Christians differed radically in their thoughts and feelings from not only Romans, but also all other people. For the other peoples, together with their gods, had more or less been absorbed by the Romans. You can see, therefore, that it was already the case that everyone looked upon Christians as different, as people with different, even opposite, feelings and sensibilities. One could simply dismiss such views by regarding them as slander. After all, it is easy to make such accusations if one takes a superficial view of history. But one will not regard it as slander if one realizes that much of what entered into Christian teaching was derived more or less verbatim. I am aware that one should not attach too much value to the way things are worded, but precisely because we do not do so, it is worth emphasizing, from the opinions of earlier times and contemporary opinions with regard to the mystery of Golgotha. Expressing the same thing more clearly, one could say, the Christians expressed their feelings with words that could already be found amongst their contemporaries. One of those who expressed more or less to the letter what can be found among the Christians was Philo of Alexandria, a figure to whom I have often referred and who was a contemporary of Christ. Philo of Alexandria makes the following remarkable statement, quote, "According to traditional teachings, I must hate what others love," close quote. He is referring to the Romans, and, quote, "and love what others hate," close quote. Again, he means the Romans. If you consider this statement and then consult the Gospels, you will find, this is Steiner again. If you consider this statement and then consult the Gospels, you will find plenty of echoes, especially in St. Matthew, of what Philo is saying here. Thus one can say that Christianity grew out of a spiritual milieu that required people to say, quote, "we love what others hate," close quote. That is to say, the Christians, and this statement often featured in the early Christian communities, and was even one of the main principles of instruction in Christian life, themselves expressed what others reproached them with. So it was not simply an instance of slander, for it accorded with what the Romans said, quote, "the Christians love what we hate, and hate what we love," close quote. But the Christians, on the other hand, said exactly the same with respect to the Romans. You can see from this that something immeasurably different from what had preceded it was now entering human evolution, for it could not otherwise have been able to make so marked an impression. Of course, if one wishes to judge this whole situation, one needs to realize that what had manifested itself had indeed come from the spiritual worlds, and that many who were, like Philo, contemporaries of the mystery of Golgotha, caught fleeting glimpses of it, and then gave expression to them in their own way. And so many passages from the Bible, which are interpreted in such a variety of ways today, as in the case of M. Barres. Readers aside, Barres, I'm pronouncing it that way, is spelled B-A-R-R-E with a grave sign over it, S, Barres, end of readers aside, whose words I quoted at the end of the previous lecture, and in such a manner that they fit in with people's opportunism, will only be seen in their true light if one does not insist on the standpoint of interpreting them in whatever way one pleases, but if the interpretation is forged out of the whole spirit of the times. There are some strange statements in the Gospels, and they are sometimes interpreted today in very curious ways. But much that Philo says is in harmony with the Gospels. I should therefore like to share with you a sentence from Philo, from which you will see that merely because he was not so inspired as the evangelists were, to be, subsequently, he wrote in a somewhat different way from them. Because he was a professional writer, his way of expressing what he had to say did not make such demands on the reader as was necessary in order to understand the evangelists. In this striking sentence, Philo gave expression to much that was living in people's hearts and heads, quote, "Do not worry about genealogical records or the documents of despots. Take no thought for bodily concerns. Do not ascribe civil rights and freedoms to the citizen, or a lack of freedom to those of humble origin, or to slaves obtained through purchase, but give heed only to the ancestry of the soul." Close quote. If you read the Gospels with understanding, you will not fail to recognize that, albeit raised to a higher level, something of this same mental attitude pervades the Gospels, and that therefore it is very possible for a modern opportunist to say the sort of things that I read to you in my previous lecture. It is worth our while to take careful note of what he has to say, and I shall therefore read this passage again. Quote, "It is totally futile to seek the afterlife. It probably does not even exist. And no matter how we approach the problem, we are never any the wiser. Let us leave any form of occultism to initiates and charlatans. Whatever form mysticism may take, it is totally irrational. Rather, let us submit to the authority of the Church, because it has formulated the rules of ethics in which nations and children need to be instructed with the authority of centuries and with great practical experience. And finally, because far from delivering us into the hands of mysticism, it directly defends us against it, silences the voices of the mystic groves, explains the Gospels, and tailors the magnanimous anarchism of the Savior to the needs of society." Close quote. In a statement of the kind that I quoted to you from Philo, you can see, since it is echoed again and again in the Bible, in the New Testament, what really lies behind the whole movement. And when Philo speaks of the ancestry of the soul, he means, among many other things, something that rises up against all the prevailing ideas in the Roman Empire. For the Roman Empire was interested only in the ancestry of the body, in its various forms. And the whole social order was based on this. And then, suddenly, someone said, quote, "Take no thought of bodily concerns, but give heed only to the ancestry of the soul." Close quote. It would be difficult to imagine anything so radically at variance with the principles of the Roman Empire. A greater contrast could hardly be conceived of. And this contrast was raised to a higher level with the appearance of Christ Jesus. The world was indeed awaiting it, and was vigorously opposed to the world order prevailing at that time. It could be said that the Roman emperors might have found it right to include Christ into the pantheon of their gods as a new god, to join their other gods, even though what was appearing through him negated the very essence of their social structures. And in this way, the Christ God, who, to put it mildly, embodies a far deeper reality, would have become one of their own gods. But these initiated emperors were bound to see that they would not have an easy time with what had descended to them from spiritual heights. When initiation forces are having so strong an outward influence, as they must be having once it had become mandatory for the emperors to be initiated, as was the case in Rome after Augustus, anything that the emperors did outwardly was of course imbued with significant additional forces, including the measures and impulses through which the social order was shaped. The aims and intentions of the initiated emperors were manifested more forcefully than those of an ordinary initiate. For let us suppose that one of the emperors, who had been affected by initiation, had said, "Well now, let us imagine a hypothetical situation where the Baptist is baptizing with water. Ether bodies were loosened through this baptism with water," and of course the initiated emperors knew this, "as a result of which those being baptized acquired insight into the inner structure of the spiritual world. And they knew first and foremost that a decisive turning point in world evolution had been reached. This was what those being baptized knew through complete immersion in water. And let us now suppose that one of these initiated emperors might have said, quote, "I want to do battle," close quote. Such things occurred within the mysteries, quote, quote, "against what has intervened at this turning point in world history," close quote. The autocratic self-will of these emperors was really quite a phenomenon. It never occurred to them that they might be powerless against the will of the gods, but they resolved, and this was why they had insisted on being initiated, to take on the challenge represented by these spiritual world impulses, by in a certain sense stemming the tide of world evolution. Something of the kind has also occurred at other times, and it is happening again today. But people do not notice this. They are completely unaware of it. The following incident has a bearing on the hypothesis that I have put forward. Licinius, who in the age of Constantine ruled over the other part of the empire, had something of this sense of challenging the gods. He wanted to perform a sign, for such cultic acts or ritualistic performances symbolized the battle against the spiritual powers. He wanted to perform a cultic ceremony in order that he might demonstrate to in the public domain that he was taking up this battle. In other words, for it was baptism that had made known to the whole world that the turning point in world history had come, he wanted to ridicule baptism before those around him, and thereby combat Christianity and blunt the strength of its impulse. A special festival was organized for this purpose, a spectacle at Heliopolis. It was arranged that a thespian, by name of Galasinus, was to be submerged in warm water, dressed in a white baptismal robe. This was to be a real spectacle, and the intention was to mock the Christian baptism. Galasinus was therefore dressed in a white priestly garment, was immersed in warm water and pulled out again, and everyone was supposed to laugh at him. And what happened? Well, he said, quote, "Now I am a Christian, and will remain so with every fiber of my being," close quote. This was Licinius's answer from the spiritual world. Instead of a mockery of baptism, the effects of baptism became manifest to him. He recognized that a turning point in world history had come. Such an initiated emperor as Licinius had taken upon himself to consult the gods and even challenge them, and had received a dismissive answer. It would be difficult for us in our time to form a clear idea of the significance that such an answer has. It was at that time a fully valid answer for all people, including the heathen, an answer that had to be reckoned with. Something had entered from another source into the consciousness of those who were at that time familiar with the mysteries of world events, which gave them confidence in the thoughts that arose through the spread of Christianity. All manner of different customs, all of which had an occult significance, had been transmitted from ancient times. In the Antonine Age, the Sibyls spoke, or people heard and took advice from them, from the Sibylline oracles. One important oracle from the Antonine Age had expressly stated that Rome was doomed to destruction. Ancient Rome would not survive. Well, oracles speak in such a way that their meaning is ambiguous, but can be understood perfectly well. This oracle spoke in a strange way. It said that, quote, Rome will perish, and in the place where Rome, where ancient Rome once stood, foxes and wolves will roam and exercise their dominion there. Close quote. This was also something that people took seriously. Of course, they sought a deeper meaning behind this, but they felt that a turning point in world history had come. They knew that what had come to wield such power in Rome would fade. Foxes and wolves will be everywhere and will take charge. Naturally, oracles are often ambiguous, and from time to time, even in those days, the aura of initiation was transmitted through an ordinary uninitiated sage, so that he sometimes said remarkable things which can only be understood as having a connection with the time of the turning point in world history. In my previous lecture, I spoke to you about Nero and about what this initiated emperor actually thought. He wanted to set the world on fire so that he might be there to see its end. So if the end of Rome, that is to say Rome's sovereignty over the globe, was going to come about, he wanted to have some degree of control over it. Seneca once gave him a warning in a remarkable statement, which can be understood only if one knows that the Roman emperors, who were in possession of the principle of initiation, believed that they had the omnipotent powers of gods, a degree of veneration which the Christians were not willing to offer them. Seneca, who knew of no other way of telling this man, with absolute authority, what he needed to impart to him, said to Nero, quote, "You have great power. You can even have these people killed, who you think might be able to contribute something to the world order that will emerge after the downfall of Rome. But there is," said Seneca, "one thing that no despot can do. He cannot bring about the murder of his successor." Close quote. These were deeply meaningful words. They should not, of course, be understood as referring to a successor as yet to be determined, but to the actual successor. Seneca wanted to indicate to him that death set a limit to his power. Thus the idea of Rome's downfall was already playing a significant part in the cultural circles of Rome. It is striking that the Christians had a radically different view of this idea from the Romans. This is really quite a paradox. When they were amongst themselves, the Christians advocated the notion that Rome would not perish, but that the dominion of Rome would last until the end, that is to say, until the end of the particular era in question. Thus it was the Christians who championed the idea that Roman sovereignty would endure, and that it would survive the wolves and foxes. It was not that the Christians would have denied, to speak somewhat in terms of the oracle, that wolves and foxes would make Rome their natural habitat, but they nevertheless maintained that the dominion of Rome will continue. We need to keep all these different moods and attitudes in mind. Much of their substance has even become a reality. Thus, for example, Alexander Severus's mother, who was a pupil of Origen, who, despite being suspected of heresy, was nevertheless regarded as a kind of church father, had managed to set up a sort of pantheon of devotion for her private use. For in her private chambers She venerated Abraham, Orpheus, Apollonius of Tyana, and Christ at one and the same time, and was convinced that bestowing reverence upon these four was both necessary and right for her own salvation. Moreover, as a good pupil of Origen, she found that such a practice was in no sense at variance with his teaching. Now, if we consider these shades of opinion, which I have tried to characterize in brief outline, we find that they reflect the attitudes of the early centuries of the Christian era up till the 4th century. Again and again we find initiated emperors who endeavored to amalgamate Christianity with their religious systems coming to terms with Christianity. This is indeed the case right through until the 4th century, despite the persecutions of Christians recorded by history. In the 4th century, as you know, a remarkable personality appeared in the figure of the Emperor Constantine, the contemporary of Licinius. He was an outstanding personality, both in an outward sense but also spiritually. And I have indicated on other occasions how spiritual forces were at work in the figure of Constantine in his complex task of guiding the destiny of the Western Empire. We shall consider him today from another point of view. Although he was a figure of such stature, also in a spiritual sense, his spiritual affinities were such that he was unable to have a real relationship to the old initiation. He recoiled, in a certain sense, from what his predecessors and contemporaries did not forbear to do, namely forcibly initiating themselves into the old mysteries. He was also burdened in his soul by the Sibylline oracles and by all the other things that were known about the downfall of the Roman Empire, and so forth. But he knew, in addition, that the Christians held the idea that Rome would last until the end of the world. He knew about all these things. But he had a dread of being initiated in the old mysteries. He had a dread of having, in a certain sense, to engage in a battle with Christianity in the realm of the mysteries. This is of great significance. What history relates about the Emperor Constantine is extraordinarily interesting and shows that Constantine tried to acquire a relationship to Christianity in a different way, in that he emerged as the great protector of Christianity, in the sense that he wholly incorporated Christianity, in the way that he understood it, into the Roman Empire. But he was unable to connect this Christianity with the old principle of initiation. There was a great difficulty in this, because the Christians themselves and their leaders had very strongly resisted such an attitude on the grounds that they had a feeling, and indeed an insight, that through Christianity the old mysteries, which were veiled in secrecy in the temples of the mysteries, should be made outwardly visible on the stage of world history, and thus placed before the world. They wanted to present the truths of the mysteries before the whole world, instead of restricting them solely to the temples. The initiated emperors, on the other hand, had a fundamental desire that Christianity should be withdrawn from the world into the temples of the mysteries. People would then be initiated into Christianity in the same way as they had been initiated into the secrets of the ancient pagan mysteries. But it was also difficult for Constantine to achieve what he sought in the face of what the Christians were aspiring toward. For the way that the Christians understood the impulse, which was, in their opinion, to become a force in the world at this turning point in world history, was as a wholly spiritual impulse. This notion is reflected with particular clarity in the occult teachings of the early Christians. By saying that the Roman Empire would endure, they were at that time already indicating something that has actually happened. I recently pointed out to you that the deeper impulse of the Imperium Romanum has not ceased, but lives on, and not only in the realm of jurisprudence. The significant point here is that many things have appeared in various domains which those who do not look beneath the surface regard as new, whereas nothing has actually been added to what has emanated from Rome. There has simply been a prolongation, an extension of the impulses of the Imperium Romanum. Although the ancient Roman Empire no longer exists, its spirit lives on and is present in our world on a very broad scale and at a deep level. Certain people who are aware of the mysteries speak of how the ghost of the old Roman Empire continues to live amongst us as a specter that haunts our world and will continue to do so. This is a constant adage, expressed even today by those who know about such things, and is something that one will always hear. The Christians wanted to indicate something similar. But at the same time, they wanted to say that in Christianity there will always be something that is antagonistic to Rome. The supersensible element in Christianity will always be at odds with the Roman preoccupation with the sense-perceptible world. Thus the idea about Rome promoted by the Christians was prophetic. You will also understand more clearly why the Roman senators and emperors were worried, for they inevitably related the decline of Rome to the outward empire, and they saw it gradually disintegrating under the influence of Christianity. A man such as the Emperor Constantine was strongly influenced by such a picture. Despite not being initiated, the Emperor Constantine was well aware of the existence of an ancient wisdom, when, in olden times, human beings possessed an atavistic clairvoyance. This ancient wisdom was then transmitted to later ages, was preserved by the priests, and was gradually corrupted, but it certainly existed. "We Romans," Constantine said to himself, "also have something in our social order that is associated with the institutions engendered by this primal wisdom, although we have buried it beneath the social order of an empire founded upon materialistic principles." This was expressed in an important symbol, which is an imagination, although it is not merely an imagination, but a cultic act arising from world history, in the way that these imaginations very often came to expression in cultic acts. This was because there was an awareness that wisdom was, in earlier times, not thought out by human beings, but was a revelation from the spiritual world. Thus the priests, who were the earliest ancestors of our own epoch, lived not in Rome, but in Ilion and in Troy. This comes to expression in the legend of the Palladium, the image of Pallas Athena that bears this name, which fell from heaven in Troy and was preserved in a sanctuary, and then came to Rome and was buried under a porphyry pillar which was erected over it. As they sensed what was associated with this imaginative cultic act, people had the feeling that they were tracing their own culture back to the ancient primal wisdom that descended from the worlds of spirit, but that they were unable to perceive the sublime form which this primal wisdom had in ancient Troy. Constantine was aware of such feelings. He therefore also felt that even if he had been initiated into the later mysteries, they would not be of much help to him. They would not lead him to the Palladium, to the ancient primal wisdom. He therefore decided to challenge the cosmic powers in his own way, by doing something to, in a certain sense, rescue the principle of the Imperium Romanum. Of course, he was not so foolish as to believe that this could be achieved in any way other than in accordance with certain cosmic impulses. He knew that it would have to be done in accordance with certain cultic acts, which are enacted over a wide historical period. He, therefore, initially decided to transfer the imperial capital of Rome to Troy, to have the Palladium dug up and brought back again to Troy. These plans were frustrated. Instead of establishing a new Rome in Troy, another plan arose to found Constantinople, and to transfer to this city the power to save the waning power of Rome for the future. He believed that by these means he would be able to forestall the turning point in world history. He was quite willing for foxes and wolves to take over Rome, as the Sibylline oracles had foretold. But he wished to transplant the hidden impulses of Rome to another site, and in a certain sense to bring them back to their source. And so he conceived the great plan of founding Constantinople, and the building work was completed in 326. You can see that he conceived of this founding deed in conjunction with the events of the great turning point of time purely through the fact that for the laying of the foundation stone he chose the time when the sun stood in the sign of the archer and the crab, ruled over the hour of the day. Thus what he did was governed by the cosmic signs. But he also wanted Constantinople to have something quite special about it. He wanted the enduring impulse of eternal Rome to be transferred to Constantinople. He therefore had the porphyry pillar transported to Constantinople, parenthesis, it was later destroyed by storms, close parenthesis, and he ordered the Palladium to be dug up and placed beneath this porphyry pillar. He had in his possession some remnants of the cross of Golgotha, and the remainder of the nails with which it was put together. He used the remnants of the cross to make a kind of frame for a particularly valuable statue of Apollo, and the nails of the cross were arranged to form a nimbus around Apollo. This was placed on the porphyry pillar, which was subsequently destroyed, and an inscription was engraved on it which said approximately, quote, "What radiates from this place radiates like the sun, and it shall proclaim the power of its founder Constantine for all eternity." Close quote. These things must, of course, be understood in a more or less imaginative way, but with the qualification that while they are to be understood in this way, they refer to very definite historical events. This whole story has passed over into legend and lives on in a metamorphosed form in the legend, which can be expressed approximately as follows. The Palladium, which is of course a symbol for a quite particular center of ancient wisdom, once resided in the secret mystery centers of the initiated priests of Troy, who kept it hidden. It then came to light for the first time when, by way of certain circuitous routes, it was transported from Troy to Rome. It then appeared for a second time when it was brought to Constantinople by Constantine. And those who acknowledge the truth of the legend add that it will see the light of day for a third time when it is taken from Constantinople to a Slavic city. This legend lives on at a deep unconscious level in all manner of ways. There are many things in our time which are manifested in aspects of a purely physical nature, which, however, are merely the outer surface of what lies hidden behind them. Constantine, therefore, wanted directly to counteract the decline of the Imperium Romanum, despite his firm belief in the Sibylline Oracle. He sought to remove Rome from the place of its own downfall. Now, in everything that I have told you, you need to be aware of impulses living in the soul of the Emperor Constantine, who was a personality of world historical dimensions, which had significant and far-reaching effects. And if you also bear in mind what the first Christians and their leaders had said, quote, "No, the Imperium Romanum will not come to an end. It will survive. And the impulse that we have received will also come to fulfillment. It will be an enduring presence." Close quote. You have something of significance which has a bearing on a number of different elements which have played a part in the cultural development of the West. It will above all be possible for you to form a picture of how people in the early Christian centuries, right up to the time of the Emperor Constantine, thought about Rome and about the Imperium Romanum, and how there were radically diverging views as to the way that people thought about the future. And you will perhaps find clues to enable you to see many of the events that were to come later in their true light. Many of these later events can be rightly evaluated only if one answers the following question: how does what has been happening hitherto accord with what was intended? And what needs to happen if it is to be more in harmony with these original intentions? It will therefore be essential that we focus upon an even more important moment in evolution with respect to the expansion of Christianity, when an initiated Roman emperor called Julian the Apostate encountered the developments that were taking place within Christianity. Finally, we may conclude this historically based study by considering the question, how can we approach Christ as his etheric presence becomes a reality in the world in this century? How can we prepare our souls so as to discover how we may draw near to him in our time? Next time, I should like to discuss the situation surrounding the initiated emperor, Julian the Apostate, and to give some indications about the relationship of our present age to Christ, insofar as this theme can be addressed today. The end of Lecture 13.